let's start with our motivation. Okay, so again, having a sense of our opportunity and the shortness of it. And let's really take the essence, pay attention, learn the Dharma, take it home and think about it, put it into practice, and use it to progress on the path to generating compassion and wisdom and full Buddhahood. I want to go back to the Gumchen Lamrim because there's a few things I didn't read. Yeah, so the section, the drawbacks of not meditating on the awareness of death. I'll read this. This will be like a review of what we talked about before. Okay? So, by thinking every single day, today I will not die, and being concerned solely with this life, the eye of your intelligence declines. Your virtue is weak, and your three doors involved in wrongdoing. What could be worse than turning your back on the teaching in this way? Consequently, from the depth of your heart, contemplate your death, and see that the great importance you attribute to this life is futile. So there, it means the great importance in terms of the eight worldly concerns and getting what you want. Actually, this life is very important because we have a precious human life, but it's not important for the sake of having a good time and procuring the worldly concerns. And then the advantages of meditating on death, then the Gomchen Lamrim says, maintaining the idea that you will not die is the source of all misery, while awareness of death is a mine of all excellence. In brief, at this time when you have attained the means to achieve beings' goals, understand the faults of postponing Dharma practice, of sleep and lethargy, meaningless talk, food and drink, distraction and so forth, and instill in your mind uncertainty regarding the time of your death. Okay? So it's very true why we have this opportunity to really use it and not spend it on sleep, lethargy, meaningless talk, blah, blah, food and drink, excessive email, yeah, excessive exercise of your thumbs, yeah, excessive surfing the internet, distraction and so forth. And then what kind of awareness of death to produce? And this is quite important because if we don't understand this, then we meditate and come with the wrong conclusion. So then, although you cannot actually halt death, you should fear a death associated with negativity. Dying after you have stopped the causes for lower rebirth and produce the causes of higher rebirths and highest good is the wise person's practice. Okay, so we don't want to have a fear of death that's this panicked, like, I'm gonna die, I'm terrified of it, you know, anxiety, freak out. That's not what this meditation's designed to do, okay? It's designed to help us overcome that kind of response to death. But what the kind of fear we're supposed to have, you know, from doing the meditation on death, is the fear of dying with a lot of negativity. Yeah, the fear having all that negativity, and then as we're dying, have the signs that we're going to be born in an unfortunate rebirth. That's what we want to avoid and have a sense of fear of. Okay. Once we've stopped the causes of lower rebirth and created the causes of upper rebirth, okay, then that's the, it says that's the wise person's practice. So that's what we want to come out of this meditation with. Okay. So, here too it says the point isn't to develop fear of ordinary death, but to think of future lives and the suffering of the lower realms. Okay. And then have that, you know, so it's not just freak out at death, but seeing what goes beyond death, and therefore using that to really emphasize to ourselves the importance of making our life meaningful by purification of negativity, creating virtue, yeah, listening to the teachings, putting them into practice. Yeah. So not just a life involved in the eight worldly concerns, where at the end of it, all you have is a computer full of photos to show for your whole life. You know, well, that's kind of old-fashioned. I guess you would have an abundance on Instagram of photos or whatever the latest thing people are using, you know, of photos. And then but you know, after we die, somebody's just going to delete all that. Yeah, because all the photos that we think were so exciting, illustrating our life, nobody else thinks are nearly so exciting. You know, they may look at a few of them and go, boring. And then press the delete button. After we've saved all the photos, categorized them, labeled them. Yeah? So it's the photo album of my life. Okay, that's not what we want to have when we leave, you know? But if we're just involved in the eight worldly concerns, that's kind of all you're left with in old age. We used to make scrapbooks. Remember the old days when you made scrapbooks? Yeah. Now you just put it all on a... Yeah? On some device, and there it is. Okay, so now we're coming to the nine-point death meditation, which was from Tsongkhapa himself. Yeah? So, it has 3 points. And each point has 3 sub-points, and each of the main points also has a conclusion that you want to reach at the end. And I thought it was particularly noteworthy that at a monastic conference, Bhikkhu Bodhi commented on this 9-point death meditation and how he thought it was so well done, and powerful when you meditate on it. Okay? So the first point is that death is inevitable. So the Gomchen Lamrim says, thinking that it is certain that death will come and that nothing can turn the Lord of Death back. Okay. So when we talk of the Lord of Death, we don't mean a real being. It's a figurative being, but, you know, it works, doesn't it? So for now, it is difficult to be fearless in the face of death. Isn't it? Yeah? The impermanence, so there's a quote here from the Lalita Shvitara Sutra. It's a beautiful quotation. Lalita Vishtara. Yeah, I said it right. Sutra. It's a sutra, I think, that talks a lot about the Buddha's life. In Borobudur, scenes from it are carved in the side of the stupa. So there's a quote from it that's very beautiful. The impermanence of the three worlds is like autumn clouds. Being's birth and death is like watching scenes from a play. beings' lives pass like flashes of lightning in the cloud and are swiftly spent like water down a steep mountainside. I find that imagery quite evocative. Okay. So the impermanence of the three worlds is like autumn clouds. We have fog now, but last week we had autumn clouds. Yeah? And they came and went quite quickly, didn't they? Yeah? You could stand there and you would just watch them. They'd be at different levels and sail across the sky at different levels. Yeah? And so the impermanence of the three worlds, the desire realm, for material realm and immaterial realm, are exactly like that, just the clouds going across the sky. Nothing can stop them. Okay? Beings' birth and death is like watching scenes from a play. Yeah? A play isn't real, is it? Yeah. You watch it, it brings up a lot of emotion, there's a lot of stuff going on, but it's totally unreal. Yeah. And beings' lives pass like flashes of lightning in the sky. The summer we get lightning storms. Yeah. Lightning doesn't last long. And you know, you think about that because, you know, so many people write to us to pray for people when, you know, who have died. And I always think, you know, that at the end of your life, it really is like a flash of lightning. It's gone like this. Even though while we're living it, we feel our lives are so long. But, you know, at the end, it's gone. And I think, you know, we're praying for so-and-so to have a rebirth, except so-and-so no longer exists. Because the aggregates that name was designated on are gone. Completely gone. You know? So we're dedicating for this person. There's a name. Their possessions may be here. You know, their whole device full of photos with their life. But that person that's labeled independence on those aggregates in that life no longer exists. You have the continuity of the consciousness, but that person, yeah, the body's gone, buried, burned, whatever. The mental consciousness, or the consciousnesses of a human being, are now, they've been let go of, and new consciousnesses, new mental aggregates have been taken up. Okay. So like flashes of lightning. And then beings' lives are swiftly spent like water down a steep mountainside. So when you stand and watch a stream or stand and watch a waterfall, you know, so quickly and no way to stop it. So I find that these kind of images quite good just to sit and contemplate, let them percolate in your mind. Yeah. And you think, you know, like you think of your parents' life, if your parents aren't here, if they still are, think of your grandparents' lives. And, you know, they had this whole life, they were born, they lived, all these things happened, maybe they grew up in a certain place, and, you know, they knew all about that place. And now they're gone. And the place where they were from, you know, it's changed too, even though the name is still there. But, you know, the place like sees so many different people's lives, and you can't hold on to any of those lives. Yeah, what's happening in somebody's life is ending the moment it's starting. Every event, you know, arising, abiding, ceasing at the same time. Okay. So when thoroughly trained in the notion of impermanence, there is no single external phenomena that does not demonstrate it. In other words, anything you're doing in your life, all you have to do is look at anything, and if you're thinking properly, it will remind you of impermanence. Yeah. And the impermanence of our own life, too. Yeah. Have you ever thought that, you know, sometime, a bunch of people are going to be sending emails around with your name as the subject line, and then in the email, you know, we're very sorry to inform you, so-and-so died last night, at such and such a time, and that's it. And then, you know, this email gets forwarded to all these people, people open it, and they go, oh, that's too bad. And then they go right back to what they were doing before. Yeah? Oh, I knew her. I knew him. Oh, they were such a nice person. That's too bad. Yeah. And back, you know, to their coffee, back to whatever they're doing. It's true, isn't it? So someday they're going to write that. Somebody's going to send around that email. So of course, you know, we're attached to our reputation after death. So we want to, you know, write our obituary now. Let's write the email now so that they say the right things about us after we die. Yeah. I mean, you don't want them to misspell your name. Yeah. And if you're a bhikshuni, you don't want them to call you a shramanari. Yeah. And if you're Canadian, you don't want them to call you American.
That one's already written.
Yeah. So, but then some of the people are going to get that email and go, oh, that name sounds familiar.
Was that?
You know, and then maybe they look in their address book online, you know. No, they weren't in my address book. How did I get this email? Who is that person? And then they go back to what they were doing. We want everybody to know, you know, that we're no longer here and to miss us. Yeah. And have a beautiful, obit. So people read, oh, that was a good human being that died. Yeah. And then, you know, because you're dead, then everybody who criticized you before now has to say nice things. Yeah, because you can never say mean things about somebody who's dead. So the people who used to trash you, oh, she's so nice. Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay, so the first point is death is inevitable. That's the main point. And under it, okay, is the first point is that it's definite that the Lord of Death will come and no circumstance can turn him back. In other words, everybody who's born will die. And death is the result of birth. Yeah. So what did they say? Maybe, was it birth? Is a sexually transmitted... No, death.
No, it was birth.
Birth is a sexually transmitted...
Terminal illness.
Terminal illness, yeah. That's it. Yeah. Sexually transmitted terminal illness. That's birth. And death comes because there's birth. You know, so, you know, whenever we hear somebody's being born, we get so excited. Oh, so-and-so's having a baby. Have you noticed people very seldom write to us and ask us to pray for babies being born?
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, very seldom. Yeah, they only ask us to pray when somebody's sick or there's some misfortune or when somebody dies. Yeah, they don't ask us to pray to celebrate the ripening of some good karma. Yeah, or birth at all. Quite interesting. Okay, so just this fact, you know, to see when you look at babies, you know, that child's going to die. Yeah. And everybody who's born is going to die. And it's interesting. I remember when I lived in Dharamsala, one of the people who lived next door to me had a young child. And, you know, I used to think that child, yeah, is going to be an adult and someday they're going to die. Yeah. But you're looking at this child and it's like death is the furthest thing away. But also, too, how many people die when they're children? A lot of them do. Okay, so to really contemplate this thing that as soon as there's birth, there's death, and there's no way to avoid it. And even when you think of all the famous people, all the rich people, even the religious leaders, all of them have died too, except the ones that are still alive that will die. But it's not like wealth or political power or any of those things save you from death. You know, the Lord of Death is the great equalizer. Mm-hmm. And so you contemplate that for a while and really think of different people that you know, including yourself. Yeah. And this is actually very helpful because how many times have we thought of the people that we care about as dying? Yeah? Have you ever imagined the people that you care about, what they're going to look like when they're dead? Yeah? Have you ever imagined them dying and what's that going to be like for them? Yeah? So, you know, many people haven't ever thought about it and don't want to think about it at all. But it's good to think about that, because if you think of those people, you know, that they're going to die, then when they die, you aren't all flipped out about it. Whereas if you don't think about it, then when they die, you know, you become so upset because, yeah, it's such shocking news. Okay. Then the second point under that is that our lifespan can't be extended when it's time for us to die. And with each passing moment, we approach death. Okay? So death is definite. With each moment, we're approaching death. And nothing can prevent, when it's time for us to die, nothing can prevent that from happening. Do you ever get a feeling when you wake up in the morning like, gee, I just woke up a few hours ago? You know, this feeling like you're repeating the same thing in a similar way. Oh, I just woke up a few hours ago. And then every day is just going, 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 going. Yeah? And I noticed this especially during winter retreat. You know, at the very beginning of winter retreat, the first week seems very rich and like there's a lot happening in the first week of retreat. And then after that, it feels like every morning comes very quickly, and before you know it, the retreat is over. Yeah? Do you have that sensation? I have it every winter during winter retreat. Yeah? It just goes very quickly. Yeah. Or we start the summer with, you know, working in the forest. And it seems like, oh, we're going to the forest every day. This is lasting for a long time. And then, boing, you know, summer's ended. And then 2 weeks ago, we had temperatures in the 70s, didn't we? And now we're in the 40s. Well, the high in the 40s, yeah, the low in the 20s. So, you know, things changing very quickly, very quickly. And we're getting closer to the time of death, not farther away. And the third point in that is we will die even if we have not had the time while alive to practice the Dharma. Okay. So they... Okay, I should be reading these points here. So what I read before was the first point. In the Gomchen Lamrim, the second point, thinking that lifespan cannot be extended and shortens increasingly, what it says, unceasingly, yeah. Although still alive, every day you come closer to death. Heroic being, when on your first night you enter a womb in this world, from that time onwards, every day, unceasingly, you race towards the Lord of Death. That's all, also from the Lidishvara Sutra. Okay. And then the third point, we will die, thinking that you will die without having had the time to practice the Dharma while alive. Okay. And, you know, someone asked me, a few months ago, like, why is this point here? It seems like this point should be under the next major point, which is death is uncertain. And I've always thought that myself. I don't quite understand why this point is here, you know. But when very old and very young, you do not recall the teaching. Okay, mine doesn't work properly. In between, you spend your time over food, drink, illness, complaining, talking about politics, criticizing other people, gossiping, shopping, drinking and drugging, worrying, and the like. So that even if you live 100 years, it is barely possible to find time for the Dharma. It's true, isn't it? Yeah. It seems like there's lots of time, but, you know, being the one who teaches classes that people try to come to, it's amazing how difficult it is for them to come to classes consistently. Yeah. Even here at the Abbey, how many of you here want, you know, a teaching from beginning to end, attending every single class? You know, you're always getting sick, or you're tired, or, you know, something happens. Very difficult. But I really see in the city, just not only in the city, here too. I mean, people come with this incredible passion for the Dharma and really wanting to practice. But as soon as there's the smallest change in their circumstance, the Dharma's the first thing to go. So if they're single when they meet the Dharma, they get into a relationship and they no longer come. If they're married, when they meet the Dharma, they get separated or their spouse dies, then they stop the Dharma. You know, you would think that would be something that would shake somebody up sufficiently, that would make them turn to the Dharma more. Mm-mm. Yeah, there's a change in life, stop. Yeah. If you're unemployed and you get a job, you stop the Dharma. If you're employed, and you're going to teachings, and you get laid off, you stop the Dharma. It's amazing to watch this. How difficult it is. not just due, this isn't due to external conditions, this is due to people's mindset. Yeah, that makes it very difficult to really continue. And then, of course, there's the book of 5,213 excuses why, you know, oh, sorry, not excuses, good reasons why you can't attend something. I remember one time when I was living in Seattle, I was late for a teaching, and I had a really good reason. I was going to put it in this book of, you know, what was it now? It had something to do with a watermelon. Either the watermelon dropped and it cracked and all over the floor, or the cat did something with the watermelon. I can't see my good excuse. It was a great excuse. I was sure it wasn't in the book, you know? But, you know, there's always reasons why we can't do something. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So although it is uncertain whether today you will die or live, maintaining that the former, that you will die, is the way of the wise. By maintaining the latter, thinking that you'll live, when the time comes to die, you will be filled with regrets. If you have to die, isn't it best to be prepared? Isn't it best to be prepared? Yeah. We like to prepare for everything else in our life. We don't go in cold. And yet death is one thing, don't want to think about, don't want to prepare for it. Yeah. But, you know, it's coming. And it will come. Maybe the point here is that, you know, death is definite. It will come whether we've been able to practice the Dharma or not. So this mind that says, you know, I'll practice later, yeah, doesn't work much. But we always have a reason why we can't practice now, why now isn't the best circumstance. Yeah. I'm traveling a lot now, so it's difficult to keep a routine, so I can't practice regularly. Okay. Now I'm back at home, I'm settled down, I live in a place. Oh, I also can't practice regularly because I got to go to work and I have my whole daily routine that I need to do, and people are counting on me. Yeah. So before you have kids, you know, oh, you know, I'm single, but I have this fantastic social life, and I go out this one and that one. We go here and there. We do so much stuff. You know, I'll have time to practice after I get married and have kids. You know, then you get married and have kids, and like, forget it. Yeah, totally forget it. Very difficult to practice when you're married and have kids. Extremely difficult. Yeah. I mean, people say it's a good practice because you have to learn to be patient with your kids and so on. That's all very true. But, you know, having time to really sit and look at your mind, very difficult. Yeah. Because your kids come first, don't they? Yeah. And your kids need to be diapered, they need to be fed. They need to, you know, someone to make sure they brush their teeth and do their homework and, you know, do all these things. So you got to be there to take care of them. Okay, so the conclusion from these three points, no, you know, the conclusion is death is definite. And so, I mean, that's the point. So the conclusion is, since death is definite, then I must practice the Dharma. Okay. Why must I practice the Dharma? Because how, you know, the extent to which I've purified and accumulated merit and planted seeds of the teachings in my mind is going to influence how I die and what my rebirth is. Yeah, nothing else will. I can't buy a lottery ticket that, you know, that's going to get me a new rebirth. I can't, at the end of my life, you know, pay off the Lord of Death with some bakshish and then go on, you know, and have a good rebirth. That doesn't work. Okay? So it's like, you know, practicing the Dharma is the only thing that is going to help us at the time of death. So since the death is definite, we need to practice. Okay? Practicing the Dharma means transforming our mind. Yeah. Doesn't mean doing tons of rituals and looking holy. It means transforming the, you know, when our mind is overwhelmed by an affliction, being able to liberate the mind, at least temporarily, from that affliction. Okay, then the second major point is contemplating the uncertainty as to the time of death. So there's three points under this. So the first one is, in general, there is no certainty of lifespan in our world, especially during these degenerate times. Or here it says, thinking that in this world, as lifespan is uncertain, there is no certainty as to the time of death. The lifespan is extremely uncertain in our world, our type of human world. Okay? And it's true, isn't it? Yeah. They put out statistics, men live so long, women live so long. That's no guarantee for any of us that we're going to live that long at all. You know, the time of death is completely uncertain. We really don't know what, you know, when it's going to happen. So we all kind of think, oh, I'll have a long life. Death will come later, 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 you know. But it's really very uncertain when it's going to come. So along this line, it's very helpful to go to cemeteries and read the plaques and see how long the people there lived. Yeah? And there's a lot of people, whatever your age, there's a lot of people who have died when they were younger than you. Hmm? A lot of people who have died when they're younger. And it's very interesting, not interesting, it's very moving, when you start to think of all the people you know who have died. I remember when I first started practicing Dharma, every time I did retreat, I would write a list of the people I knew who had died. Now I don't even try because there's so many. You know, the longer you live, the more people you know who have died. And then you think about how they died. All these people that you know, how did they die? So, you know, that was really the instability of life, the uncertainty of the time of death, really came home to me when I first met the Dharma. You know, some of you have heard the story about Teresa, my friend who I sat next to at my very first Dharma class course, and we were going to meet in Kathmandu and attend the Kopan course, and she never came, you know, because she was transiting in Bangkok, went to a party, met a man, he invited her out to lunch. It turned out that he was a serial killer, and they found her body in a Bangkok canal. You know, and this was my friend Teresa. We were, you know, about the same age, met the Dharma together. We were going to have, you know, go have chocolate cake on Freak Street, and she never made it. The first person, when I first, before I even went to that course, I went to a talk that a nun was giving. And I was very taken with it. I had been to Nepal and India before. And I told her, you know, if anybody's coming into town for the course, I'm happy to offer them a place to stay. So this one woman, Vicky, came and stayed with me. And several years after that, she too was dead. I forget of what. Yeah. There was one man who was at the first course I attended. I heard that after the course he did something and he wound up jumping out of a building. I don't know, but he was dead. Boy, when I lived in Italy, quite a number of those people that I knew then, yeah, died. One, Sam's younger brother, who was a really nice guy, got murdered on a beach in Italy. I don't know how, but he got murdered in his 30s. One young man who came to the center, Giovanni, who drove everybody nuts, but I had a fondness for him. We got along. He also died. What happened? He went to India and he died. I forget how he died, but also in his 20s he died. One of the guys who we used to work on making the sadhanas together, I heard when I went to Frankfurt last summer, that he had just died. No, many people from that time. And, you know, then I look at the different places I've lived as a nun, and many people who were my friends, who were my age when I lived there, you know, have all died. Some from diseases, some from accidents. Yeah, all sorts of things at all different ages. Totally unpredictable. Yeah. Why Sam's younger brother died, you know, and Sam, the older brother, didn't die, you know? Some kind of karma ripening there. Yeah. So it's interesting when you think back. You know, I've never gone to a high school reunion. But sometimes I wonder how many people from my high school class are still alive. Yeah. Like, you know, because years go by and people die for all sorts of things. How many of them are still alive? And even if I went to a reunion, I doubt I'd recognize anybody anyway. Yeah. Okay, so there's no certainty of lifespan in our world. We could die at any time. Remember when Venerable Choki and, what was the other nun's name? When they were staying here and they were driving here and Venerable Kim.
Yeah.
And the truck they were driving wound up in a ditch. You know, I mean, they could have been killed. Just they were driving home from somewhere. Yeah, I remember some time ago we were asked to pray for one woman who had two young children. She had gone to the grocery store. Remember, it was in Canada. Somebody in Canada, I think, and on the way back was hit by a car. Yeah, gone.
A young man.
Yes, Unje, remember him? This wonderful young man, Korean American, who came to the Abbey for about a week, 5 days, something like that, one winter. And then he was riding his bicycle across the country to raise money for, what was the program he was in? It was something, you know, like one of the volunteer organizations for
Catholic charity.
It was something where the young people worked, you know, in social service areas. So he was raising money for that by riding his bike across the country. And in Colorado, on the highway, some lady who was, I think, on pills or something like that, hit him. Gone. He was like, what, late 20s? Mid-20s? Maybe 23, 24, you think? Yeah. So really, you know, the time of death, totally unknown. Yeah. And people who have come to retreat, remember Bonnie, who went to sleep one night, didn't wake up?
And her plan was to, when I retire, then I'm going to really practice. She was a lawyer.
Yeah.
Too busy. When I retire, then I practice.
Yeah. And she never got to that. And then another friend who was also a lawyer who came to retreat got ALS. She's gone. Yeah. So, and then our friend Bill. Yeah, Bill, who was very active and helped the Abbey quite a bit. You know, one of the early friends of Savasti Abbey members died. Was it last summer?
Two
summers ago. Yeah. And there's somebody else that now just went out of my mind. But, you know.
Marianne.
Yeah. Pat. Also, who helped us plan the Abbey?
Bob Van Vee.
Robert Cottery. You know. Yeah, a lot of people who have helped the Abbey, you know, who live in the local area. So, you know, you really don't know what time. And when you really think of all these different ways that people die. I had one friend, and her brother's wife was studying belly dancing. And so this was many years ago, so she would put on a record and practice her belly dancing. And then, you know, play the record again and practice. And she was young, in her 20s. And at one point, you know, the record stopped and she didn't go back and put it on again to continue practicing. And her husband went in the room and she was on the floor dead. She had some, I don't know, aneurysm or something. Yeah. So it's quite amazing, you know, that just death can happen very suddenly when you don't expect it. Or Jim Blumenthal.
That 16-year-old boy that graduated from high school, Jamaica.
The what?
The boy who brought off
Catherine Brockhoff.
Oh, yes. Her son, who had just graduated from high school, and he went to the Bahamas or the Caribbean somewhere, and they found him in his hotel room dead. They don't know what caused it.
Meningitis or something.
Huh?
They do know now, but...
They do know now?
I think it was some kind of meningitis.
Wow. Because he was fine earlier that day.
Yeah.
Wow. So... Yeah, very quickly, you know, you're fine, and then, toom. Okay? So, no certainty of lifespan in our world. Then, second point is there are more chances of dying and less chances of remaining alive. So, thinking also that as the body is extremely fragile, there is no certainty as to the time of death. So this feeble body carries innumerable factors of death. Yeah. And it's true, isn't it? You know, when you really think of it, we have to work very hard to stay alive. Yeah, from morning to night. Yeah, if we're too cold, we have to cover ourselves because otherwise we'll get sick. Yeah, then we have to work hard to get food. We have to make sure we drink enough water. Yeah, we have to stay warm enough, or we have to stay cool enough. Yeah, when we get injured, we have to treat it. If we don't treat it, we can get infections. Yeah. There's so many germs floating around, yeah, and we get sick with hardly anything happening. So when you really think about it, you know, we have to work very hard to stay alive, but dying, you know, with all the germs, the bacteria, everything comes, very easy to get injured. Yeah. And also, if we just plain old don't do anything, then we'll die. You know? If you don't do anything and you just lie there, you're going to starve to death. You're going to die of thirst. Yeah. So we have to work very hard to be alive. And then, even some of the things that we do to try and stay alive become the cause of our death. I had one friend who was, I think he was maybe 40, 41 when it happened. He and his wife were building their dream house, I think in Hawaii or somewhere. They had a child. And it was a Friday, and he was building the house, and he was just finishing up, and he was going to come down, and then they were going to have dinner. And he slipped and fell. And a piece of rebar went like right through his throat, and she heard something and went out there, and he died just like that while she was holding him, you know. And they were building their dream house. So I always think, be careful when you're doing your dream, you know, because you don't quite know what's going to happen with it. Yeah. So here you're building a house to protect you from the elements, and building the house is what kills you. You eat food. My dad. Yeah. My dad eating food in order to stay alive, and then you choke on the food and die. Yeah. So, you know, even the things that we have to keep us alive can become the cause of death. People driving in automobile accidents. You know, the autos are supposed to, cars are supposed to help you, and then they turn into the thing that kills you. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then the third point under that is that our body is extremely fragile. Actually, yeah, no, it's the second one on this list. It's the third one on this list. Okay, so the second one on the, and the Gomchen Lamrim is the body is extremely fragile. Okay, yeah, and then the third one was the thinking that the causes of death are money and those of life are few. And the other one I have, the order is reversed. Mm-hmm. So I actually just got done explaining the third one in the Gomchen, and then the second one, that the body's extremely fragile. That's for sure, you know. I mean, we can get hurt by the smallest, tiniest little thing, can't we? Yeah. Some wasp comes, and if you're allergic and you get bitten, then you could die from that. By bacteria, viruses, any kinds of just small things can become the cause of death. Yeah. And when you think about it, the body really is fragile. I mean, our skin is not very strong. Yeah, our bones are not very strong. Nothing really is so strong, and very easily can get damaged. We feel like we have a strong body. And especially when you're young, you kind of feel like you're totally invincible. Yeah. You do all sorts of stupid things because, you know, death only happens to old people. Yeah. We could probably spend an interesting evening telling stories about stupid things we did. Yeah. We should do that sometime. You know? Make a cup of tea and sit around the table and tell the stories of the stupid things we did and how extremely fortunate we are that we lived through all the stupid things we did. Yeah? I mean, I look at some of the things I did and it's like, yeah, stupid.
We always have these kind of nice ideas that we should sit around and then we never do that, so we should do it tomorrow.
Okay, then we'll only have one session of teachings tomorrow and the other session will be
about teaching.
So, from contemplating the three points under the time of death is uncertain, we reach the conclusion, not just that we have to practice Dharma, which was the previous conclusion from the first three points, but we have to practice the Dharma now. So we can't be like Bonnie, and when I retire, I'll practice. I'm surprised so many people now, I mean, I can't believe I know people who are retiring. That's what old people do. You know? I mean, I have no... Retiring is not in my vocabulary.
Yeah.
But they all say, oh, I'm going to retire and practice the Dharma. Yeah, I wonder. Very difficult. But the point is, however old we are and whatever we can do, we need to do it now. Yeah. And not wait and not say, when I get a better condition, then I'll practice. You know, it's too cold here, I can't practice here. I have to go somewhere where it's warm, then I'll practice there. It's too noisy here, I need to go somewhere quiet, then I'll practice there. I'm too busy now, I'll wait until I retire, then I'll practice. Yeah. So, always this manana in la manana. Yeah? And it doesn't work because all of a sudden death is there. And when the Lord of Death shows up, you know, you can't say, sorry, I'm not ready. Because the thing is, people are always in the middle of doing something when they die. We always think, I will finish this, and then, you know, death won't come before I finish this. If it comes, it'll be after I finish this. But people are always in the middle of doing something when they die, you know. You have a project, you die in the middle of your project. You're making a journey, you die before you get there. You're chewing food, my dad, you die before you swallow it. Or you die because, he didn't swallow it, it swallowed him. You know? You're always in the middle of doing something. You're walking somewhere, you fall down. Yeah. You're in the middle of inhaling, and you die and you exhale. Always we're in the middle of doing something. So this mind that says, I'm too busy, death won't happen now, is a really stupid mind. Not true. Okay, then the last major point is that nothing else can help at the time of the death besides the Dharma, okay? So, at the time of death, everything but the Dharma is useless. So, in the Gomchen Lam Rim, it says, in brief, think, I will have to give up the good things of this life, and without that doubt, they too will give me up. Consequently, I shall not get caught up with my body, loved ones, and wealth, but resolve to practice the Dharma. So, in the outline, you know, for nothing can help, else can help at the time of death except the Dharma. First point is our wealth is of no help. Yeah? Doesn't matter how much you have, money you have, it cannot prevent you from dying. It cannot make a good karma ripen in your mind as you're dying. It cannot purify the negativity you've created. You know, the wealth is totally useless when you die. And if anything, it could be a hindrance, because if you haven't planned where you want it to go, then you're thinking about it, you know, right before you're dying. And it's like, oh, I didn't make out my will, and I want this to go to someone, this to go to someone, this to go to someone. I don't want this person to get anything. And then you're worried about all your possessions and how they're going to be distributed, even right before you die, because you didn't take the time to, you know, figure it all out beforehand. Yeah, and the wealth is totally of no use. You know, you die in a beautiful bed, you die on the street, it doesn't matter. You know, when you're dying, it's the last thing you're thinking about is your money. Or you want, or you hope it's the last thing you're thinking about. With some people, you know, like I said, they're really worried about what's going to happen to their money when they die. And that's a horrible way to die, thinking like that. Okay, also, at the time of death, our friends and relatives are of no help. Okay, that one's more difficult. Yeah. For some people, wealth is the big one that's hard to think of giving up their wealth. But most people can, yeah, I have to give up my wealth, okay. You know, I don't want to, but I have to. But friends and relatives, the people that you're attached to, wow, that's really hard to give up, you know. Because especially people you've known for a number of years, you've shared your life with them, you know, whether it was a brother or sister or a parent or child, you know, or a spouse, anybody you've shared a, you know, a number of years of your life with in close contact, and then you have to separate from that person. Yeah, very difficult. You know, it's like the person who understands me and knows me the best, they're, you know, they're dying or I'm dying, and there's no way that that person can prevent us from dying. Absolutely no way. Even they're a doctor, you know. And I really saw that, you know, at one of my friend's death. That, I mean, his family loved him tremendously, but when he was dying, there was no way they could help him because they were so absorbed in their own grief. You know, it was good I was there because I could help them. But they were too absorbed in their own grief to be of any assistance. Yeah? So actually having lots of friends and relatives around when you're dying, I think can be super distracting. You know, because they're all doing their own trip and saying, don't die, and we love you, and, you know, remember that fight we had 40 years ago, please forgive me. And you're trying to apologize to them for things you did, but you can no longer talk, and you were waiting until your very last breath to make amends with somebody, you know. So friends and relatives cannot help at the time of death. So the point is, here, when we're thinking about these things, if wealth cannot help us at the time of death, why get so attached to it when we're alive? Why get so upset when we don't have it or we lose it when we're alive? Why create so much negative karma out of attachment and aversion or jealousy or arrogance involving wealth and possessions if when we die we can't take the wealth with us, it can't help us, and that karma that we created comes with us instead? You know? So if these things can't help us when we're dying or after death, then why create negative karma regarding them while we're alive? Yeah. better to use them in any way we can now to create virtue. Yeah. So instead of hoarding things, giving things away. Yeah. Get rid of a lot of the possessions that we don't need, that we have, you know, just in case one day I'll need it, you know, or for sentimental value or whatever. Yeah. And better to use those things to create merit while we're alive. And same with friends and relatives. If at the time we die we're going to separate from them, then why create so much negative karma while we're alive in relationship to them? Being attached to them and then, you know, cheating other people to get things to give to our loved ones, yeah, or stealing, or, you know, telling off the people who insult or criticize or harm our loved ones. You know? Or, I mean, all the different ways we retaliate for somebody, against you know, somebody who has harmed a person that we care about a great deal. So we create a lot of negative karma that way. Or, you know, the people that we care about, that we love, i.e. are attached to the most, are the people we fight with the most, aren't they? The people you yell and scream at and have the knockdown, drag-eye fights are not with some stranger walking down the street. They're with the people that we're most attached to. And at that moment, we're not getting along. Yeah, what we really want at that moment is to be close to them, but we're so angry, they're so angry, and we create a ton of negative karma in relationship to the people we care a lot about, isn't it? You know, in families, the kind of fighting that goes on in families is horrible. Worse than, you know, worse than fighting with strangers, isn't it? What people say to each other in family fights. Yeah, so, and that comes because we're so attached. Because the more attached we are to someone, the more upset we get when we're not as close to them as we want to be, or when they do something that we don't like, or we don't approve of, or that adversely, affects us. We get so upset, creates so much negative karma. And then the third point there is that our body also is not of any help at the time of death. In fact, the body is a total nuisance at the time of death because it's painful. Yeah? And here's this body, you know, that you look, that we pamper and we treasure and, you know, we take such good care of. We take better care of our body than we do of our possessions or of our friends or relatives. You know, this body is me or part of me, and, you know, it's got to be comfortable all the time. Huh? And what we do if the body's even a teeny bit uncomfortable. Yeah? Our knees hurt. Oh, I can't meditate. Yeah. I have the sniffles. Oh, can't go to the hall. You know, any small thing, then with this body, I mean, we pamper the body so much. And then we do so many things to make it look good, to keep it healthy, to keep it in shape. Yeah. And then spend so much time keeping it alive, doing it things for this body. And then what does it do to repay our kindness? It dies. You know? It walks out and abandons us. Yeah? And so, you know, when you think sometimes of the kind of karma we create out of attachment to this body, and yet this body, you know, is no big friend of ours. You know, it's the source of it can be a pain in the neck. Literally and figuratively. Yeah, can't it? Yeah, you want to do something and the body's sick, the body's uncomfortable, the body gets hurt, you know? Then it interferes with your practice. Okay. So the whole point of this is, again, don't create. Let's not create so much negative karma trying to keep this body happy. If at the end of the day, it, you know, we can't take it with us and it's not of any benefit to us at the time we die. Yeah. Okay. And so the conclusion from that third main point with its three subpoints is that the only thing that makes sense in life is to practice Dharma, to do it now, and to do it purely, without mixing it with the eight worldly concerns. Yeah. So there's a certain urgency to practice the Dharma because we don't know when we'll die. You know? And if we put it off, we wind up not getting to practice and our practice getting very polluted by the eight worldly concerns. Whereas if we really, you know, take to heart that death is definite, the time is indefinite, and that body, friends and relatives, and wealth don't help at the time of death, you know, then we really, it really comes across to us, yeah, the only really important thing to do is to practice the Dharma, meaning to transform my mind. Yeah? And so that gives us a lot of energy to practice. And it's a good kind of energy to practice because we know that, you know, why are we practicing? Because we want something good to come from it, and we know that practicing will lead to something good. Okay? So it's a big motivator. And this, you know, meditation, remembering death, you know, also helps us to really make wise decisions in our life. What are we going to do? What's valuable and what's not valuable? Okay. So, I think good to think about that. If you have any questions, maybe write them down or whatever, and we can do them the first thing next week. But in the meantime, stay with what you've heard and think about.